When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to Season 4 of What I Did Next from A&T Media. I'm Malak Fouad, and I hope you're enjoying the lineup so far. If you've heard the show before, you'll know that my guests are leaders in their fields from across the Middle East, and our conversations revolve around their life's pivot points. We all have these points in life. Some are hard, and some happen without you knowing, and some are magical, taking you into a whole new direction. I'm joined on the show today by a living legend, Tariq Nour. Tariq Nour single-handedly revolutionized the advertising world in Egypt and the larger Middle East. Through his passion and love for music, he made household names out of brands with catchy jingles and his signature unmistakable voiceovers. Every consumer product at the time clamored for the Tariq Nour magic, knowing that his stardust would help sell their goods. Today, Tariq is semi-retired, active in some aspects of his business, but also able to sit back, relax, and take a bird's-eye view of the industry, his life, and his beloved Egypt. Our conversation took place in Guna, which is always conducive to allowing for leisurely and unhurried conversation. Tariq is very much a man of his time, the 1960s, but he's also a man for the ages, able to adapt, take on board new ideas with the wide-eyed curiosity and intellect of a truly enlightened, content, and happy person. We began our chat with him juxtaposing his life with seminal moments in Egypt's recent history.
You know, when you asked me to sit down with me for an interview, and I looked at the environment landscape that I was born in.
Yes.
And that environment landscape is actually, when I put it down on paper, it was very surprising to me that my generation went through all this. So I put it on paper.
Go ahead, tell me what you're thinking.
Yeah, I can tell you that I was born 3 years before the 1948 war. I was born 7 years before the 1952 revolution. I was born 11 years before the 56 Suez Canal War, 17 years before Egypt suddenly became a socialist country, 22 years before the 1967 war, 27 years before the 1973 war, my God, 36 years before the assassination of Sadat and the appearance of fundamental Islam. From the age of 36 to 66, a relatively calm period where nothing happened in the time of Mubarak, that ended up by the 2011 revolution. But that did not work and destroyed, everybody knows that, destroyed Egypt's economy up to this day. Not that it wasn't, you know, that it worked well before. I was born 67 years before the rise up of the Muslim Brothers declaring political Islam and 1 year of Islamic rule. 68 years before the 30th of July to 2012 revolution and the declaration of President Sisi, President of Egypt. So I'm from a generation that has seen 9 heads of state, 4 wars, 30 prime ministers.
It's a lot.
My God.
It's
3
a lot.
Revolutions, more than 70 years of constant financial crisis. We lived under socialism, capitalism. Actually, we lived under monarchy.
Yeah.
And then socialism, then capitalism, and then political Islam back to.
So you've seen it all in terms of the political landscape.
I come from a generation that has seen the wealth of monarchy and the poverty of socialism and the open borders of free economy. Yes, I think we've seen it all.
I want to move a little bit towards the actual beginning of your business.
I began in 1973.
Yeah.
My first ad, Viona.
Yes.
Ishr al-Shaar.
Yes.
Bayona, you know, the dandruff.
Yeah.
I remember this happened because I was with Madame Laila Kirdani, who was my boss in the radio station, and I used to have a musical program called Pop and Underground Scene. And she said, Tariq, can you find a way for us to get advertising? Because, you know, we don't have a penny, and so that we can pay you. And that passed, you know. But through that, I when I met Laurie, I said, no, you know, I have to do something with my life. And then I went to do actually technology and computers in Al Ahram. And we were on the 11th floor. On the 10th floor, there was an advertising agency of the Al Ahram. That's where the link happened. And from that program on radio, somebody heard my program and called me and said, you know, can you do advertising? I said, of course not. I cannot do. I cannot operate the camera. I've never directed in my life. I never wrote anything. And he said, his name was Abdullah Shabka. He was an account executive in Al Ahram advertising agency. Allah irhamu ba. And I said, fine. Madame Laila Kirdani wanted me to do that, you know, that for them. And so I went to a friend, Saad Hathout. He had a shop in Sharif Street called Playboy. And he just came from Canada. Never seen somebody who taken so much money every single day. He didn't have time to sell. I mean, you know, boom, boom.
But from what? He was selling clothes.
Clothes. And I was sitting next to him, next to the...
the cashier.
Cashier. And I used to hold the cashier up and down, up and down, and close. And so I asked him, I said, why don't you do some advertising? He told me, you're crazy. You can see, I don't need advertising. I said, Malish, for me, yani. And we did it.
So he was your first ad?
He was my first ad on the radio.
On the radio. And you voiced it?
No.
No.
No, no, no. Actually, it was a jingle, of course, because I was a musician.
The jingle king also, known as that.
And so Abdullah Shabka heard that and said, okay, you must do a television ad. And I said, I don't know anybody. And so it introduced me to somebody called Abdul Latif Fahmy. His name is Tutu, very well known as a cinematographer. And we went to the American University, found a few girls, made our first ad on television called Bayona for Dandruff. Mm-hmm. And black and white at the time. Incredible. You make me go back so much in time. And I did that. And all of a sudden, you know, all hell broke loose. And they said, you know, people started to look for me.
But tell me, Tariq, what was it about that first ad that was different to what was already being seen on TV? Because clearly there was a difference in what you had produced and what was already out there.
It's a very, very, very funny story, because advertising at that time was press-based. I mean, you know, the press would, you know, the everyday newspaper would sell advertising. TV advertising was animation, cartoon. Mm.
It wasn't real people in real life stories.
No. And in fact, it was at the time when even the press made a lot of huge, not grammatical mistakes, but mistakes like, for example, they would forget a point or forget the aleph of the thing. And I remember an ad at that time, Al-Hajj Abd Salam Akbar Ma'arad fi Masr. The biggest shop in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And they forgot the point on the dud. So it made him Al-Hajj Muhammad Abd Salam the biggest pimp in Egypt. It's incredible.
It totally changed the meaning. Yeah, yeah.
It totally changed him from the world of advertising.
Of course. He never understood. He got ejected from it all.
Oh, yeah. So that was the world at that time.
At that time.
You know, it's like I say, it's the world of black and white. And then I went into television, and then things, you know, with the mindset of somebody who can play foreign jingles, but transposed into Arabic jingles.
See, that's what I find really interesting, because those early years were so, what's the word? Were so, such a homegrown product, right? They were so...
associated with the ruh of Egypt, right? And yet, here you are saying that you brought with you know-how or techniques that you might have seen when you were in California, but you still translated them into a very localized product. And you are forever associated with those, you know, those childhood people remember from their childhood, these ads.
Well, that came from my childhood as well.
Yeah.
With the Lamloum family.
Yes.
And the power of imagination. And that later came on to be the slogan of that I work by, nothing like the power of imagination. What is imagination? It's the unconventional thought. It's the other angle. It's the enemy of the ordinary, whereby things can go out of the tunnel they have and extend their aperture and dare to go into the uncommon sense, if you will. The logical of the illogical. And I took that as fascinating because I always get fascinated. I'm equally fascinated by the intelligence of people and their wit, equally fascinated by being dorky or being unintelligent. I'm always fascinated. Mm-hmm. As I said, you know, I wake up every morning with that feeling in mind. I'm completely, I look at people and go into this world of how are they like this. And this is how I went through that every person is a product of their own environment. And so they form their opinion because of the 2,000 people they have really known in their lives, while we are 8 billion people in this world. And so that showed me how limited we are in our knowledge and our view of things and our opinion.
Yeah.
And so that's why I developed to be a little bit tolerating to other people's and why they are like this.
So based on what you're saying, you are very much a boy of the 60s, and you seem to be a very firm believer in that your inspiration and your work can only have been produced because you were from a certain time.
A certain time that has seen a lot of revolutions. I'm somebody that came and saw all this. Even in Egypt, when you think about black and white television, when you think about telephones with dials, when you think about satellite, I'm also a product of, the last thing that happened that also I believe is changing the world of communication, which is the 2020 pandemic, and that subjected us all to stay indoors. Mm-hmm. And I believe that 2020 was a pivotal year in changing a lot of things in our lives. Mm-hmm. And it got me a little bit concerned of what's going to happen with technology. Mm-hmm. Because although technology is going to be of benefit to humankind, it also can be a horrible thing that
yeah.
can happen because of your own interests.
I just want to go back one a little bit earlier when you actually did begin your company. So we're talking 1973.
1976, I started a company. Mm-hmm. With my partner Nasser Kharafi from Kuwait.
This is Americana.
This is Americana.
Yep.
And the reason why I called it Americana Advertising Agency is because I had about 20 to 30 ads on TV every night. Mm-hmm. So I thought that I would help his business, Americana, by having the same
name.
The same name. And from there, and I remember I took £100,000 to start that company. And alhamdulillah, it just evolved into a very successful business later on.
And your establishment of the company came at the same time as the Iftitah, Sadat's Iftitah.
Right.
So you were part of a generation and a group of individuals who was the new Egypt, the reawakening, the reopening. It must have been a very exciting time to be launching this business and riding that positivity that was being felt in Egypt at the time, I think.
Yes, and it was because of Anwar Sadat.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, which is 180 degrees away from
where
socialism
we all were. Yeah.
To open borders.
Yeah, yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
Although the open borders, I mean, everybody makes mistakes. I mean, once you embark on that direction, the opposite direction, of course there is going to be consequences. But that doesn't mean that it's supposedly bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's because there are a lot of people who come and say, you know, that it's just too quick, all of this.
Yeah.
It just was a natural evolution of Egypt.
And tell me, Tarek, when you were in the 70s and specifically in the 80s, when there was the rise of political Islam, were you conscious of trying to counter that in certain messages?
Again, because of the environment I was born in, the very, very open environment I was born in, I was completely against closing up one's mind, actually. And also being a prisoner of your own environment. I refused to get stuck in it because I am born a Muslim, because you know, all these... all these limits the world has imposed on you, or humanity has imposed on you, the ability of seeing a wider angle was possible for everyone, and there's no fear into going into that world. I'm somebody who would jump in the ocean and look for the safety thing, ring, you know.
And your opinion on the Egyptian character, because I always think of Egyptians as inherently a positive, want to have a good time, not very serious, but in a good way, not in a bad way. And so a philosophy or an ideology like political Islam, in my mind, would never stick long term here because we like to have fun. What do you think of that?
Again, you're speaking about, you know, within the realm of your own environment in which you were born in, and because you, Malak, have been subjected to the world, to a global existence. It's not the same here.
I'm not thinking of myself. I'm thinking of the average Egyptian. They don't want to be told what to do.
Well, nobody likes to be told what to do, but, you know, it depends on what you know, it depends very much if you are in a time of need or not. These people are, if you're extremely poor, if you never have been given the chance to have to speak your own mind, so of course you listen to people. Of course you will go and seek advice. Now, if you go and seek advice from somebody who's good, fine. If somebody who's wants to manipulate you, that's the bad thing, but it's normal. It's normal. The Egyptian people are naturally, I don't know if anybody would say that about their own people, but I'm amazed by their intelligence. I'm amazed by their wit. I'm amazed by their ability to survive for such a long time in that environment.
That's what I mean.
They're incredible people, but they also... everybody works for their own interests. And if your own interest is to eat, all you want to do is eat, definitely you're going to be manipulated and you're going to listen mm-hmm. to somebody else mm-hmm. who mm-hmm. you don't even like.
Yeah.
If your child and a friend are fell out in the water and both of them are drowning, who would you save?
You would save your child.
Your own interest. Your own interest. So your own interest is a natural thing that anybody's going to do. And not to be scolded for that. It's only something.
It's natural. Yeah.
It's especially a motherly instinct and a fatherly one as well.
What were the highlights of the period of being in the joint venture with Americana and Khurafi? In terms of the ads, what are the ones that stand out in your mind as the epitome of that period for you?
I remember that the Americana ads that we did for them in Kuwait and were huge success. I mean, they contributed to a lot in their companies, not to say that they had great Egyptian management. That was led by a friend of mine now, a very good friend of mine now, Amjad El Mufti.
So we're talking their brand, so KFC, Pizza Hut,
and all the advertising. You know that I just got, as I told you,
you don't remember.
I don't remember, but I do remember the advertising later on.
Yeah.
That happened, which is like the Secret of Schweppes, for example. Mm-hmm.
That was a very big campaign.
Very big campaign.
Very popular.
Yeah. And also the campaign of the taxes campaign, mm-hmm. the RIBE, with Youssef Boutros Ghali, that made actually Egypt, it made the number one revenue for Egypt up to this day, just because Youssef Boutros Ghali observed the rule of campaigns of that sort, and he continued 5 years in a row that campaign. And so 5 years, it got us real results. And this is a campaign where you can actually calculate the results. How much did you make when we started? How much did you make as a country? Mm-hmm. And I considered that to be the best I have done, mm-hmm. and the something really fulfilling,
yeah.
to know that I've helped the country.
Absolutely.
In that way. Yeah.
Although working with Americana and its brands propelled Tariq's career, both as an ad man and as an entrepreneur, that partnership came to an abrupt end. We get into that pivotal moment after this break.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible, because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome back. I'm Malak Fouad, and you're listening to my conversation with Tariq Noor.
Some of my listeners might not know about the period when you and Americana went your separate ways. Tell me a little bit about what happened there.
This was a very, very, very sad situation. This was 1997. I was in Greece and coming back. And let me go back. Before I went to Greece, I had a visit from the guy I was dealing with under Nasser Khorafi. And he decided all of a sudden, he surprised me to say, look, we would like to name another chairman for our company. Obvious question, why? He said, no, it's just, you know, he didn't tell me the real reason. And I never knew the reason why until this day. So that straight away told me that this was time for me to get away, because clearly he didn't understand the type of work that I was in, and that it had to do with talent. And that the people that I have in my company are extremely loyal to that talent that I brought into the country. And so actually what he was doing, he was ending the company. But I didn't expect one thing, which is when I was away, when I was in Greece, to be attacked by a bunch of people, you know, in order to frame... I don't know. It was something very, very strange. It was the first time that this happens in the business community. And I went to, I came back, I was afraid to go home because of what happened. An attack on your, and then.
The attack took place on.
They attacked the office.
They attacked the main office.
Yeah, it was a big office because it has, you know, it has. And they were met by resistance of our own security, who were there 2 days before, because our managers saw that there were people were roaming around. And this was my first shock at how business could be that violent. It's horrible. It's a shock. It made me rethink many other things. It's a point in my life, which is very painful for me to think about, and it's changed a lot of things. It ended up by both of us going to see the prime minister, and he told us, "Look, we are embarking on a private sector situation here, where we would like the private." And this is not a good example. You're not doing a good example. And And it ended up by, and he said, you either buy him or you buy, there's no point in him buying me out. So I bought him out, because him buying me out means the end of the company. You know, it's another business. Americana is a food business and this is other. But it ended up by me buying him out.
And changing the name of the company, obviously.
Changing the name of the company to my name. Actually, the problem was at that time that I wanted the name of Tariq Noor Americana. He wanted the name Tariq Noor Americana, my name. I said, it's impossible for you to take my name. Otherwise, I wouldn't exist. Mm. So we decided in the end to split. I mean, me giving him the name Americana and me keeping my name. And that's where the second stage of my work began, which is Tariq Noor Communication.
And I want to just pause there a minute, Tariq. What did you learn from the experience? What did it, I mean, you mentioned that it taught you that there was a very ugly side to business, clearly. But what did you learn in terms of going forward for the next phase for you?
I learned that for the first time in my life, like Bill Gates said to the Harvard graduates, that life is not fair, that business life is not fair and you better get used to it, because it was a shock to me. I mean, to me, everything until that time was, you know, it was a rosy life. Mm-hmm. We were making money. We were happy. There was, I never thought that partners would do this.
And you had gotten along well with your partners until that point.
Extremely. And it was a very big, I mean, that we had somebody in the middle that was not happy with that relationship between me and Nasser Kharafi. This is what I learned. I mean, you know, that there was another side to business and the lesson of my life, really.
And then, so after that, you started on your own.
And after that, I continued because I was on my own from the beginning and they were silent partners. I continued my business and went elsewhere.
And you took no more partners at this point? You decided?
No, we did. We did. Our partners came in 2008, and they at that time they were the biggest advertising agency worldwide, DDB, and they were part of the Omnicom group, which was the biggest communication group at the time. The reason why I was very happy with this company, because the name DDB, the last was Birnbach, and Birnbach was viewed as the guru of advertising at that time. He was a fantastic copywriter. A little bit like Ogilvy, Ogilvy and Mather. And so I was very proud to be.
But why did you feel the need to partner with an international company? Did you have ambitions to go outside of Egypt? Or because you were already such a huge name in the Middle East and in Egypt, why the need to add another partner? Why not try? Why not do it alone?
Well, I mean, you know, it's evolution. I mean, it's the difference between being local and getting a lot of experience from the States where advertising really was businessized. And so it's in the quest to learn more about my work and getting exposed more to the international advertising agency, especially that at that time, lots of international agencies started
in Egypt.
To come in Egypt. Yeah. And so therefore, we needed to have an international name with us in order to compete. And so that's the reason. We're still partners up to this moment.
When we come back, we'll move on to an important personal pivot for Tariq.
I wanted to take a minute to tell you about our bonus episodes, available exclusively for subscribers. On each bonus episode, I take a deeper dive into my guests' industries, and I share some extra parts from our conversation. For example, actor and comedian Rami Youssef told me about his thoughts on cancel culture, and ex-anchor and now author Hela Gorani told me her thoughts on the future of journalism. All of these great stories are only available on our bonus episodes, so subscribe now to unlock this amazing extra content. You can subscribe in Apple Podcasts by clicking the subscribe button or on our website and get instant access to all our bonus episodes with a 2-week free trial. And now, back to the show. Welcome back again. I'm Malak Fouad and you're listening to What I Did Next. This is my chat with Tariq Noor. I want to move on, Tariq, please, to a personal thing, which is you were ill a few years ago in 2015. You had cancer. You had prostate cancer. I was also ill at a younger age than you. Same illness. What did that teach you? How did it change you?
It happened in the beginning of November 2014. Lori and me were going to California on the plane. And I looked at a magazine. And in that magazine was a very well-known personality. I think he was an actor or a singer. And they were, interviewing his wife. And she said, never believe doctors when it comes. My husband died of prostate cancer. And you have to go through, after the age of 40, you have to go through, especially for men and women, breast cancer. You have to go through the process of looking after your prostate. Because if you catch it early, like every cancer, it's fine. Then I closed that magazine, and then we stayed at Lori's best friend in Los Angeles. And throughout the visit, I hear the name Dr. Bowie every time. And Dr. Bowie was an oncologist, and he was the doctor of a friend of Diane, which is Lori's best friend. And I would say, who's Dr. Bowie? He says, it's because of Cy, and I don't know, he has prostate cancer. He said, okay, I want to go and see him.
Had you ever tested for this before? Had you done regular checkups anyway?
I was fine. I was 4 point something, which is fine for my age. And every doctor would tell me, it's fine for your age. So I went to the doctor, Bowie, and he said, I have this, and I have my PSA is 4.3. And he says, that's fine for your age. He said, that's exactly what I don't want to hear. I want to make tests. He says, fine, if you want to spend some money, but I'm telling you, you're okay. I said, yes, I do. And then, okay, he said, I'll do an MRI first. If I find something in the MRI, we'll go on from there. He did find something in the MRI. There was a shadow.
But Tariq, that's incredible that you pushed for that when you had an instinct or you had a feeling?
That's what Lori always said. It is an instinct.
Because you had no symptoms, right?
No. And the doctor told me, you've got an angel on your shoulder. And then we went and saw the doctor. Surprise, I've got not good news to tell you. You have 90% aggressive cancer in your prostate. And he didn't know if it went out or not. They would only really know after the operation. And he said, it's up to you. At your age, you can not make an operation because it's a very, very slow-moving cancer.
So they wanted to remove the tumor?
They wanted to remove the prostate. It's 95%.
The whole prostate?
The whole prostate. It's like a ping pong ball. And there is a way to and now they have a robot-like, procedure.
Very laparoscopic. Thin. Laparoscopic, yeah. I think they call it. Yeah.
But with a robot called the Da Vinci method.
With doctors, you feel, you have a, I mean, with my doctor, I knew immediately that my father wanted me to have a second opinion. And I said, no, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to do it with this guy. I knew. I felt comfortable with him.
Yeah, that's the most important thing. Now, the period when he told me, look, after I make the operation, I'm going to know if something came out or not. Which obviously, after I made the operation afterwards, nothing happened. But in those 2 months that I stayed, he told me to take care of your things, to start thinking that you might,
to put your affairs in order. Isn't that what they call it?
Yes. And I remember I lived my life normally. I wasn't even thinking.
It didn't upset you?
I'm not at all, Malak. It's incredible. It's like I was laughing. I was doing everything. So I discovered something about myself is that I'm really, I go with the flow.
That's a character thing, isn't it? But had your affairs been in order?
It's fatalistic.
Because that also matters. Are you the sort of person who was always careful with your finances, with your, did you keep Lori and your son in the loop of things? Were things already established on that
definitely
front?
Definitely, I'm a family man. Yeah. I kept Lori and Kareem definitely in the loop all the time. It was a venture, and I decided, this institution called marriage is to behave like it is an institution. And so therefore I've got duties. And so therefore everybody knew everything. They can do anything. And there was a trust and there was all of this. in mind. But of course, like, you know, when you have 2 months.
He told you that, the doctor?
Yeah, he gave me, you have 2 months to, because if I find something, it's a matter of time. If I find something, if I find something, it's between 2 and 3 years. So I would have 2 or 3 years to do that. But it, in those 2 months, he said, you know, take care of your things. And I found out that, you know, it was life as usual for me. There was no problem. I didn't, you know, when I'm a very vocal person, and I would ask my friends, how are you? Oh, I have cancer. I said, what? You know? And I found that many, many people would hide that information. And I didn't understand why, because it's not logical. I mean, you know, throughout my questions, I found a lot of information that I need to know. And then I found that a lot of people I didn't know had cancer, had cancer.
For me, Tariq, I find that also, I'm like you, I'm very open about these things. And I found that very fascinating. I moved to Egypt 20 years ago, and I found that that closeness was very much an Egyptian thing, or maybe an Arab thing, I don't know. But people hide, for example, their parents go to a doctor and the children don't tell the mother or the father that they're ill. I find that so difficult to understand.
I do too.
And I don't understand that that person has a right to know what's happening to them. And I don't understand that sort of logic. But it's very common.
That goes again to the environment you were born in and what has become of you and why you hide such an information. Yeah. Is it because of it's not, you know.
My sahish or Abe or I don't understand, how can it be?
My sister died of cancer. My half-sister died of cancer, Basmanur. And after she died, her sister told me that, Aliyah told me that she didn't want to tell you because she didn't want to bother you. And she did not want you to
worry.
To worry. That's another reason. So it's not only...
That's a big reason a lot of people have.
So that's not only to hide the shame of...
So the learning for you, I'm asking you, have you learned to live more fully? Or have you always lived your life and you've carried on living your life in the same way?
I have always lived my life in the same way, fully. I have even made slogans about this. Always told people you've got 20 summers left. And 20 summers does not mean 20. It could be 30, it could be 40, it could be 5. But that means that summer is the time where we have time to go out and see friends and enjoy ourselves and to do things we haven't done in the whole year. So I think that I would tell you, if you want something to do and you can afford to do it now. You don't have time.
Yeah.
20 times is not much.
Yeah.
To the point where one of the biggies in DDB in New York made a club called 20 Summers. You know, the philosophy beyond thinking that we don't have time, that time is our enemy. And so I have lived fully.
And after you got better, alhamdulillah, you're fine. Did you then take a step back from the company? Was that maybe a subconscious thing that you decided I want to?
I don't know if this was an element that made me step back, but, you know, just like I made the decision to get married at the age of what I should have been married, just like, you know, I was took a decision to go in the world of music. Just like I made the decision to win in sports, like I was I was a champion of squash at the under 17 between Egypt and Syria. So I went through the motions of everything, and being a, you know, it's the reason why I went into to this. Is what I learned at school and the want to win, Jesuit type of thing.
Are you Jesuit? Were you in a Jesuit?
No? Yes, I was, yeah. So I'm French educated. And so between the Charles Aznavour and and Edith Piaf and the Who and Jimi Hendrix.
So yeah, yeah, a total lots of influences.
Oh my God.
Yeah, yeah.
And يا حلاوة السخان.
Yeah, everything is there.
خلص الفول أنا مش مسؤول.
But أيوه. But that's Egypt for you. It's a melting pot. It always has been.
It is. It's an amalgamation and an extremely rich life. And the time I was born in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, let me ask you a question. What do you think the new generations are going to go through and in the next 50 years?
You know, that's a huge question. And it's a question I ask myself a lot because I have two children, 17 and 15-year-old boys. And they're at that age where, you know, you and me knew an analog age. They didn't know the analog age. They're not aware of it. They were very too young. Their entire life has been lived in a digital environment where the online world is in complete parallel to the world that we walk around in. And I think that is going to impact their lives in a way that I can't understand, I can't imagine. I don't know how that's going to be for them. I worry about it, but people who know more about this than I do, people like Mo Gaudat, we talked a lot about this in my interview with him. He's a positive believer in what AI can give us, and as long as it's harnessed correctly. So I don't know. I don't know what to expect. But on the other side, the other big question for their generation, which, you know, you and I are now recording this on the first day of COP27, is climate change. Climate change, I think, is going to transform their world in a very negative way. We're going to have water shortages, we're going to have sea levels rising, and especially in Egypt, we have a lot of these issues. Potentially, Alexandria won't exist by the time my children are old men. Who knows? I think that the climate issue is going to really take over as the most pressing issue of their generation.
You know, between generation, between the agriculture generation and for example, in the industrial generation, it was 100 years, and then 150 years after that. Now it's
quicker.
It's accelerating, and it's every single day you wake up to to something else. And so the future is extremely unknown, not only unknown, but the fear of that machines are going to take over. I mean, it sounds like, for example, Jules Verne and going to the moon at the time.
Yeah.
It was an impossible thing. But I think it's going to be reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's going to change even our physical appearance.
Yes.
And and so therefore, you know, this generation, my generation more than yours, we as long as we keep a little bit abreast of what's happening now, is we can only tell the future generations to take care of technology, because technology, in the end, as much as it can help you, it can completely destroy you.
Mm-hmm.
And is there something they can do about it? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something they can do about global warming? I don't know.
Mm.
Because this takes, you know...
it takes a global effort.
A global effort to do that. And then you are fighting against other people's interests.
Exactly.
How can you do
exactly.
that? I mean, you know, that's the scary, scary thing about what's going
to
happen.
It is. So what is next for you? You are semi-retired. You're involved in your business still, more on the TV side. How much time does that take of your daily life, and what else are you doing with your time? What do you see coming up for you?
I would like to. What's coming up for me is the conversions of conventional communication that I said changed in 2020 because of biotechnology, and I would like to. For my people and my associates at work to really think about the world of communication next. And I would like to tell the people that the world of conventional media although it could be dead to some people, it isn't dead to others. And media is media. So calling it conventional is just a tool. It's just a media that has changed to something that we don't know going to happen, because my work is really, you know, is selling a product or a service to somebody else.
You're selling a story.
Or selling somebody to somebody else. And in the end, so therefore, knowing who you're going to sell it to, and that who is going to be calculated by machines, and even they're going to tell you what creative you should do, or the components at least of what you should do, and even the emotional side of it can be calculated. Mm-hmm. I don't pretend they would know the answer, but to get ready for if they want to continue in that business, for that world, and it's going to happen sooner. Sooner, much sooner than they think.
I interviewed recently on this season Amy Mouefi. Amy is it's a family business. They run a lot of these online publications, Cairo Scene, Cairo, a lot of these online publications, but they also have a media company. And she was saying they are moving into the metaverse. They are reformatting their company to be ready for Web3. And that entire different way of approaching media. Is that what you're referring to? Is that what you mean?
I've asked many people, what is Web3? And I found it very difficult for me to understand. And I don't think they even know where Web3 is going to take them. But I sat down with Amy on the plane coming back from Riyadh this time, and I asked her this question. Mm. And Amy is one of the people that are not afraid of venturing into the unknown.
Yes.
And so she's a very interesting person.
She's taken a leap of faith into this world.
Definitely. Yeah. I even asked her to make me a program or to join in a program. Is conventional media dead? She liked that. And I hope she doesn't forget.
Well, I'll make sure she listens to this.
Yes. She's a very, very, she's excited.
Yes.
She's and exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Tariq, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
This was so interesting. We discussed so many different things. I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you. I did enjoy it very much.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed hearing Tariq's story, we'll have a bonus episode for members out next week, where Tariq shares more about the evolution of the advertising industry, as well as his thoughts about technology and AI. You can sign up now in Apple Podcasts and get a 14-day free trial, and you'll get access to all our bonus episodes throughout the season. This episode of What I Did Next was brought to you by ANT Media with me, Malak Fouad, and is co-produced by Chirag Desai. You can follow us on social media for video snippets from our interviews and other updates. Just search for What I Did Next on Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We hope to see you again in 2 weeks' time, where we'll have a new episode.